Welcome back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM. Of course, we're on the web, Taylor-Report.com, where you can hear previous programs, and I hope you'll be referencing them because, for example, when Mother Agnes Miriam comes, we really want the world to know about it and what she has to say, and you can access it, Taylor-Report.com. And we're going to be talking shortly with Murray Dobbin. He is murraydobbin.ca, by the way, and you can find him at counterpunch.org, November 27. And his article is titled, Who Will Protect Libya Now? Libyans Now. And the title is Libya's Hell, Enabled by Canadian Humanitarians. And we're joined by Murray Dobbin. Are you there, sir?
Hi, Phil.
Hi. Hey, thank you very much for joining us. People should know you, of course. You're a veteran journalist. You've been a broadcaster for 40 years and following all these strange events. Your article in Counterpunch, Libya's Hell, Enabled by Canadian Humanitarians, really hits a nerve because it's been a while now since the Libyans were rescued from Gaddafi, but you're not very impressed with the rescue and the results. What's gone wrong?
Well, I mean, it's a very long and, I think, quite sordid story. I mean, people's image of Gaddafi, of course, you know, obviously he was, you know, as we understand the term, a dictator. He was not elected in parliamentary elections. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was, you know, another Mubarak or, or you know, dictators like Duvalier in Haiti.
Or a sheikh.
And in fact, he was chosen in a very long process that ended in 1969 through voting by tribal elders. As lots of your listeners will know, I mean, virtually all of the borders in Africa are completely artificial, based on colonial powers and colonial wars, you know, that go decades and even longer back. And so we're used to a relatively homogeneous country here. So when we imagine a dictatorship, which some of us think we have now, you know, we imagine a relatively homogeneous place. But Libya and many other African countries are not homogeneous. They are made up of tribes, and the only way to have a central state is to have a strong man. And the tribal leaders know this, and they choose someone who is able to balance these forces. And Gaddafi was a genius at this. You know, from 1969 until his death, he managed to, you know, keep intact a tribal society. And not only did he do that, but he did it in a way that provided Libyans with the highest standard of living in Africa. It had the highest human development index of any country, the highest literacy, the longest lifespan. You just go through all of these aspects of the human development index, and Libya was number one in Africa for many years. So the notion that somehow Libyans were completely oppressed by Gaddafi is just false. They had free Medicare. They had free education. Thousands of students studied abroad with grants from the government. But beyond that, Gaddafi was actually creating in Africa an independent continent. That was his goal. I mean, I could go on, but yeah. You might have some other questions.
Yeah. Well, on that line, people do tend to forget, and I wonder if you were struck by this, that when the so-called humanitarian intervention happened, the African Union said, please don't do this. And the party of Nelson Mandela, their spokesperson, and certainly he was speaking in the spirit of Nelson Mandela, said, this could be solved peacefully. You don't have to be bombing. And that, of course, you raised this in the article, is that what was the basis of the bombing? And could you talk about that? We had allegations of rape. We had the allegations of a decision to slaughter rebels in Benghazi, and therefore the president you know, pulled himself up to his full height and said, we have to save those poor people.
Yes. Well, I mean, this whole notion of responsibility to protect, which is just a, I think, is, you know, in Libya has been now completely discredited. It's triggered by evidence of one of four so-called mass atrocity crimes, war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, or ethnic cleansing. So if any government is clearly guilty of one of these crimes, then the international community through the UN, and this is where the responsibility to protect developed in 2005, the UN, you know, it can intervene legitimately. Well, of course, none of these things existed in Libya, and in fact, there was from the very outset, these were not peaceful. You know, the notion that there were suddenly peaceful demonstrations which were bombed by Gaddafi is completely false. From the outset, rebels were burning government vehicles, raiding police stations, and it was clearly an attempt by armed gangs to overthrow the government. At which point, of course, it became a civil war, and Gaddafi engaged his military. But up until that point, there was no long-term sort of civil disobedience or civil movement as there was in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the roots of this, I mean, the West had been waiting for a long time for precisely this kind of advantage. They saw Gaddafi as a threat, and also saw China as a threat, because China was suddenly investing $90 billion in 2009, compared to $10 billion, you know, 10 years before that. Mm-hmm. So the United States was getting extremely anxious about its so-called interests, and a lot of oil comes from Africa, it's not just mm-hmm. the Middle East. So they tried to form an organization called AFRICOM, which was to be the militarization of Africa in the interest of American investments. And Gaddafi was one of the main forces against this. And, of course, he was very prominent and very popular in the mm-hmm. African Union because he provided billions of dollars in aid to countries throughout the continent. And a number of other things that he did, he established, up until he established and paid for something like 75% to 80% of it, a telecom satellite, African countries were paying just a fortune for telecommunications. Then he was in the process of forming an African bank, an African monetary fund, all of which threatened American and Western institutions, especially finance capital. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was setting up these institutions, which would have made Africa more independent, and opposing American militarization, were an enormous threat to the West, and so they used this pretense of a democratic uprising to remove someone who was a tremendous thorn in their side. I mean, the notion that he was a thorn in their side because of terrorism, he was much more of a threat because of all these other institutions he was creating. Given up terrorism some years ago.
Yeah, I've seen it argued that actually his decision to cooperate with Western powers in fighting terrorism actually led to his being somewhat compromised in that they suddenly turned on him, despite the fact he'd been cooperating.
Well, that's right. I mean, and he'd actually established a couple of very effective intelligence institutions that had a major impact on neutralizing Al Qaeda. But you know, when you sit down, the cynicism of Western oil companies knows no bounds. And so, in spite of this cooperation, the fact
it smells of sulfur.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
This is Murray Dobbin, by the way, and it's the November 27 counterpunch.org, titled Libya's Hell, Enabled by Canadian Humanitarians. Who will protect the Libyans now? And I got to ask you, I mean, we do have a school of thought in the West of very enthusiastic R2 peers, I guess you call them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think my impression is they're losing a little bit of steam, but they're nonetheless, it's a very dubious idea of, and you name Mr. Axworthy and Mr. Rock, I think they've written a number of pieces along these lines, but the idea is we're going to do something good. We're going to step in. We don't seem to get a critical reexamination. I guess I put this in the area of our media and also our parliament. Where is the follow-up? You're suggesting, for example, is anybody going to look at this mess?
No, exactly. We've seen, this is the most shameful intervention in recent history, and it's really frightening. And I end my article by saying we should all be worried, because in a democracy, if we don't have access to the truth, then we can't, then how is it possible to make democratic decisions? And it's interesting, we did manage to have enough information on the Iraq War that citizens rose up in this country and in many other countries opposing that war and opposing Canada's involvement. And in fact, that worked, because Canadians had access to the truth about, the so-called weapons of mass destruction. But in this case, the media was studiously quiet. All the political parties in Parliament, with the exception, to her everlasting credit, of Elizabeth May of the Green Party, the NDP and the Liberals were all terrified of this issue and refused to deal with it honestly, and voted in support of this hideous bombing in which we flew 1,000 sorties to.
Punched above our weight.
Yes, isn't that wonderful? We punched above our weight.
By the way, if you punch somebody who doesn't punch you back, is that actually a fight?
Well, that's right. You basically destroyed their air force. And bombed all their facilities.
And I have to ask you about that. I mean, my memory, and maybe you could help me with it, is that actually Libya said, "Okay, we won't fly,"
but to that's
make,
right.
But to ensure it, they went ahead and said, "Well, okay, but we'll have a no-fly zone." But then they did not fly, and yet they were bombed.
Oh, exactly. And the whole notion, it's interesting that if China and Russia had known what was going to transpire, they would have opposed the UN Resolution 1973, because they were promised by the West that the military action would not go beyond a no-fly zone. But it quickly became apparent that regime change was the goal. And in fact, you mentioned the African Union begged NATO, the NATO countries, which, NATO is basically the armed branch of the UN, begged them not to bomb. And in fact, partway through this bombing, Gaddafi made it clear that he was willing to consider a ceasefire. The Western nations said there'll be no ceasefire until Gaddafi is gone. So regime change was the goal right from the outset, and all the humanitarians went along with this. And I think I just find Mr. Axworthy, who has this long reputation of being a progressive liberal, is totally complicit in what is going on in Libya now, which we haven't talked about that much, total chaos and bloodshed from one end of the country to the other.
Yes. Well, by the way, you cite an excellent book, and we had the author of the book. This is Maximilian Forte,
right.
Slouching Towards Sirte, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. And by the way, you list all the things, terrible things have happened. One of the ones that I noticed in that book and noticed at the time in the reporting was the allegation of African mercenaries, which had horrible, bloody consequences for those Libyans who happened to be black, because percentage of the Libyan population is actually African.
Yes. Well, that's right. There was one community, I've forgotten the name of it, but it was a community of 20,000 20,000 Africans, most of them Libyans, but some who had come, from other countries to work in Libya. That they were the entire community was completely destroyed, and many of its residents murdered before they could escape into other African countries. There was basically just a completely racist purge and persecution of blacks throughout Libya. And the notion that they were mercenaries. There were, many of them were Libyans. Many of them were workers brought to work on some of these amazing construction projects. One of the projects, of course, was to bring water from the south of Libya to north to basically make the deserts bloom. Enormous projects, all funded, of course, by Libyan oil, and all of those projects are now defunct. Nothing's happening there. And of course, the services that were available to Libyans have all but broken down as well.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Murray Dobbin, and the article is in Counterpunch, November 27. Who will protect Libyans now? Libya's hell enabled by Canadian humanitarians. This term, there's a couple of terms I wonder if you had trouble with. Certainly in my ear, they don't have a lot of content. Humanitarian intervention and also international community.
Yeah.
I often read that somebody says, oh, will the international community help us? And I think, oh, you poor devil, I hope you know what you mean.
Yeah, be careful what you ask for. as is obvious to anyone who thinks about it for a moment, there are many communities. One of them, I mean, you know, if you want to use that term and sort of abuse it, I suppose you could say the NATO countries are a community, but they happen to be a community of the most powerful, Western developed nations on the planet.
And light-skinned.
Yeah, light-skinned, and these are the same countries that were, you know, amongst them anyway, the same countries that colonized Africa in the first place. And so this is a community that you definitely don't want intervening. There are other communities too, of course. There's the community of African nations who opposed this intervention to begin with, but now, of course, have been brought to heel by the power of the American dollar and American military. It's interesting, within weeks of Tripoli falling, even before Gaddafi was murdered, there were U.S. soldiers were deployed to four more African nations under this AFRICOM.
It's the least they could do.
The least they could do, and then they announced 14 joint military exercises to take place this year and next, which was an unprecedented number. So as soon as Gaddafi was gone, the militarization of Africa was engaged.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you about this humanitarian aspect. You know, in order to justify ourselves and for Parliament to be completely complicit and silent and all, we had this language about, well, we're saving people and such, and we're bringing Western values and such ideas are introduced.
Right.
And then we end up with a leader of a country murdered on video, anybody wants to see it, on the Internet, and the Secretary of State of the United States kind of doing a little dance around a chair.
Oh, it was one of the most revolting.
I mean, is this a high point of Western civilization?
That's right. She said, and I quote, "We came, we conquered, he died," and then she laughed.
Yeah.
And
she
was
stole that from Pogo.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. I mean, it reminds me a bit of Madeleine Albright, who you remember years ago was asked whether 500,000 children dying every year in Iraq was not too high a price to pay for the American blockade and boycott, and she said, no, it's not too high a price.
Yeah.
So it makes the blood run cold, you know.
It does.
And
it,
she's going to, you know, and the fact, you know, there's a good chance she's going to be president of the United States, which scares me even more than Obama.
Mm-hmm. There is a president. Kind of permanent. I think if you were to freeze that picture, you'd find the people of her staff were probably Albright's, Madeleine's same people.
Mm-hmm.
They could all meet in a phone booth from one administration to the other.
Right. One of her staff actually ended up on the executive of Amnesty International in the U.S. And Amnesty, of course, to its great shame, was one of the first organizations to actually call for the humanitarian bombing of Libya.
Humanitarian bombing.
Yes, the humanitarian bombing. It should be a new phrase that we use.
Charlie Chaplin thought of
it. So you have all these organizations like Amnesty joining in on this, and now, of course, there's complete silence. No one apparently is interested in calling them to account for their support of this and their initial support of this notion of mass rape, which was just such a, well, it reminds you of the incubator stories of the first Iraq war, you know. just a completely fabricated story.
And you know, by the way, I wonder, what you, as a writer and broadcaster, you must be struck by sort of the primitive cartoonish character of this, because they had a representative of the International Criminal Court saying he had evidence that the Libyan troops had Viagra.
Right.
An enabling drug.
Yeah, as if Viagra would make you
we're in
crazy
bad shape here.
And go out raping people. I know, it was a whole thing. I mean, it's as if they don't even have to have a good lie anymore. You know, any lie will do. Yeah. You just make it up on the back of an envelope and pass it to the media, and they'll report it. Yeah.
Well, that's what strikes me. And I have to ask you this, and this is Murray Dobbin we're speaking to. Mr. Rock and Mr. Axworthy, actually, in the run-up to what we all thought was going to be an assault on Syria, really replicated their piece on Libya. They ran basically the same article,
yeah,
except that they
just
and
put
you
Syria
you asked in your
Libya
article,
was.
You know, have they no shame or do they remember Libya? It was very interesting that in the article advocating bombing Syria, they referenced Kosovo, but no reference to Libya. It's kind of like somebody went through and said, strike that out.
Yeah, people might look at that and decide that. Yeah, I mean, I think there's no limit to the shamelessness of imperialism, and people like Axworthy have always been willing junior partners in terms of the public relations for U.S. imperialism. So, I mean, it shouldn't really surprise us, but the fact that he's still seen as somehow progressive, I think, is a testament to just how much collusion there is between the state, the media, and large corporations like the oil industry.
If you're the editorial page editor and he submits the article, and you've actually been around the block, you must have to swallow and say, am I going to ask him about that piece he did for us on Libya with the same title?
Well, that's right. I mean, you'd think if it was a genuine editor and not someone who, again, is part of this collusion of right-wing ideologues. I mean, if you look at what's happened to the mainstream media in Canada, one of the major things that, and I don't think people entirely appreciate it, that when Conrad Black bought all the major newspapers in Canada, what he did, I mean, they had always been conservative and pro-business. This is nothing new. What was new was that he turned them into an institution to reverse the social contract of the post-war period in Canada, so that the media is no longer just pro-business or conservative. It is part of, you know, I mean, you can basically equate it with the Fraser Institute and the C.D. Howe Institute and Manning's, Institute for Democracy. These are all now institutions whose mandate is to reverse the progress made in terms of equality and decency in the post-war period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sort of, it's a Fox News, Murdoch kind of outlook. We're speaking to Murray Dobbin, and I have to ask this, moving this issue to Parliament. And I just spoke, by the way, to Eve Engler. We're talking about the way Haiti has turned into an ugly phenomena under UN intervention. What about an elected member of Parliament and the idea that you're supposed to try to ascertain information and about these such a phenomenon as the one in occurred in Libya, and aren't you supposed to get the answers from Canadian intelligence, for example, instead of asking NATO what you're doing? Aren't you supposed to ask your own military to report to you, since you're a Canadian parliamentarian?
Well, you would think. I mean, of course, with Stephen Harper, I mean, we have the for the first time in Canadian history, and perhaps the history of any Western world, Western country, a prime minister who has a visceral contempt for his own country, and so the notion that Mr. Harper would be defending Canadian sovereignty in any way other than as a support for business, has long since been dismissed.
But shouldn't there be a caucus of the opposition parties that stand in front of the parliament and said, we'd like some answers?
Well, yes, and I think I think that's one of the great shames. I mean, you would think that that would be the role of the NDP, which has in the past played that role of a critical voice.
Tommy Douglas, where are you?
Yes, Tommy Douglas and Woodrow Lloyd in Saskatchewan, and I mean all David Lewis. I mean all these people, would have been out, in the halls of Parliament in front of the TV cameras. Saying we have to reconsider this, but mm-hmm. I think there is an ethical crisis in the political culture in Canada, and it goes beyond just Stephen Harper. It includes the Liberal Party, it includes the NDP, which of course is now trying to become, it has a fantasy of becoming the government, and in order to do so, Mr. Mulcair is turning the NDP into a second Liberal Party. Mm-hmm. But what he's discovering is that if people want to vote Liberal, they'll vote for the real thing. And
yes.
So you now see the Liberals, going up in the polls and the NDP going down, and they deserve to be going down. I mean, they haven't put forward a principled vision of the country, and part of that is the studiously avoiding commenting on the situation in Libya.
Yeah. Well, it's an excellent article, Libyans' Hell, enabled by Canadian humanitarians. It's Murray Dobbin, Counterpunch, November the 27th. I really urge people to get a copy of it. Hey, thank you very much, Murray. Nice talking to you.
Good to talk to you, Phil.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.